This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. Today, it's our garden show. Just ahead, Charlie Nardozzi will be joining us to answer your gardening questions. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Before we get into your questions about what's going on in your garden, we're going to take a trip to the Northeast Kingdom, where a group of folks at a nonprofit have created a garden at their office. The idea of employee gardens is taking off, boosted in part by a grant that helps small businesses build gardens at workplaces. VPR's Patty Daniels has more.
We did, these are some nasturtiums. This is that, I think it's a lemon Thai basil. Yeah, you can smell it on your hands when you, smells so good.
Linda Michnowitz is admiring the leafy greens growing in the garden at her office. She's the program director for Northeast Kingdom Community Action Head Start and Early Head Start. And their central office is on a residential street in Barton.
So we have a small backyard, or, you know, medium-sized backyard. And our garden, what we decided to do, was a raised bed garden.
The garden is shaped like a large horseshoe, and that makes it easy to reach all the plants. And the entire raised garden bed is 3.5 feet off the ground, so there's no stooping over to pick the vegetables or pull weeds. So far this summer, Michnowitz and her office mates have enjoyed lots of leafy greens.
We wanted a garden that was sort of a salad garden, was what we were thinking, so that we could come down at lunchtime and basically pick our lunch. So we really wanted lots of mixed greens, but with the generous grant that we received lots of seeds too, so we didn't want those to go to waste.
The grant was from the Vermont Community Garden Network's Green Thumbs at Work program. 7 small businesses received grants this year to start employee gardens. Michnowitz's office received $500 towards supplies to build the garden, a gift certificate to Gardener Supply for tools, a donation of seeds to plant, and a lot of technical advice. Add to that the garden expertise that her staff already had, and Michnowitz says they have a lot going on in the garden.
Cucumbers, carrots, beets, we have pea pods, as well as peas, radishes, onions, celery.
But the produce itself is only part of the benefit of employee gardens. A few of the 8 staff of NEK Community Action Head Start sit around the table in their office where they normally eat lunch. The garden is also an outlet for stress, says Lynn Forsher.
You know, you go down there and it's just like everything that was bothering you when you were upstairs has gone, because you're playing in the garden, you're picking weeds, you're, you know, picking vegetables and looking at how things are growing, and it just makes you forget all about all the stresses that are going on inside the building.
Julie Lamori is the lucky one whose second floor office window overlooks the backyard garden. Forsher says that doesn't stop everyone else from checking out the view.
The majority of the people that work here, they walk through the door. The first thing they do is they go to Julie's office and they look out the window to see what the garden looks like this morning. So it's like a daily ritual. Everybody goes to the window to see what the garden's doing.
And Lamori and Forsher agree that building and tending the employee garden has one other benefit too.
Well, I think it definitely gives us something more to talk about other than work when we're talking.
What an awesome way to bring us all together and have a common thing that we can work on together.
At midsummer, more and more vegetables are ripening every week. But this office is already thinking about how to overwinter their employee garden to keep it going for seasons to come. For VPR News, I'm Patty Daniels in Barton.
We're quite proud of it.
Yeah,
we really are. Anxious for more stuff to be ripe and ready for us to harvest and eat.
The NEK Community Action Head Start Office is one of 7 small businesses that received Green Thumbs at Work grants this year from the Vermont Community Garden Network. You can learn more. We have a link to the program at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. One of the technical advisors to Green Thumbs at Work is garden consultant Charlie Nardozzi. He joins us a few times throughout the growing season to dispense advice and encouragement to get the most out of your garden. Charlie, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's good to be here, Rick.
So let's talk a little bit more about these employee gardens.
Sure.
We heard some of the benefits that the employees are getting. Fresh vegetables, a ready-made lunch, stress relief, and building camaraderie. So what have you seen while helping some of these get started?
Well, it's a way for people to really focus their attention on something kind of beyond, like they're saying, their workplace. And so they're out there, they're planning it, they're working together. And the great thing about gardens, as any gardener knows, is that there's a lot of satisfaction that comes from it, especially when you put a seed in the ground and then a month later you've got some lettuce that you're eating, or 2 months you've got some beans that you're eating. So often when you're in a workplace like a community action organization or a private company, there might be a lot of frustrations. Things aren't working. It's going on forever. You know, anywhere you work, it's kind of a natural thing that happens. Yeah. But a garden is a place where you can actually feel like you've kind of accomplished some things. You've done some stuff. And then you combine that with the idea of working together with other people, and maybe people who you haven't really had much camaraderie with or much work with. You know, that group up in Barton is a relatively small group. We have some private companies, for example, down in Rutland, the Karis Reels companies, where there's three or four different facilities and they kind of come together at this garden. So there are people talking to each other who normally would not even know that they existed.
That's fabulous.
So it's building that kind of sense of teamwork and conflict resolution and really working together for a common goal.
We had them here last year, and then in the winter, you told us to put in garlic at the end of our growing season. And so once the snow left, every day I'd walk by trying to see, where's the garlic?
Is it coming up?
Yeah, it's really exciting. But basically, what are some of the elements of doing an employee garden right?
Well, I work with the Vermont Community Garden Network, as you mentioned, and the Vermont Department of Health has helped fund this as well. And myself and the Vermont Community Garden Network, we really go in early on in the whole process. So the awards were given out in the winter, and then in April we would go on site and meet with people and really stress that the organizational side is just as important, if not more important, than the garden side of it. Because everyone wants to go like, oh, we're going to plant this, we're going to do that. But no one really talks about, well, who's going to be doing the weeding and how are you going to schedule that? And what are you going to do with the produce once it starts coming in, and who's going to get it, and how are you going to share it, and what happens if pests happen, and who's going to water on the weekends, and all those kind of organizational kind of things really have to be discussed before you even start talking about what kind of garden you're going to have and what you're going to plant. So we spend a lot of time on that whole organizational side of it. And then, of course, during the growing season, as things come up, as a technical consultant, I'm there to answer questions and kind of help them with the pests or the animals or something's not growing.
You're hearing from Charlie Nardozzi, garden expert, garden consultant. He's also the host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR. You can ask him questions now about what's happening in your garden, where you need help, where you need encouragement. Give us a call. We'll take him at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on our Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Weather, Charlie. Let's talk about that to begin with. In some parts of the state, we had a lot of snow. The winter seemed to linger, and that led to a cool spring. So what effect did those weather conditions have on our growing season?
Well, we've had a lot of rain, a lot of moisture, especially in June, one of the wettest months we've had in a long time. And that slowed a lot of things down. So if you're not seeing any ripe tomatoes or peppers or eggplants yet in your garden and you're thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to get any ripe tomatoes, don't fear. It's probably because it's been so cool and things are just a little bit slower. Plants are growing well. They're looking good. I was looking at some employee gardens the other day and they have some beautiful pepper plants and this little peppers, and they're all concerned they're not going to get any peppers.
Yeah.
But the plants will be okay. They will come along and you'll actually get some fruit from them. So things, the warm season crops are definitely slower than they normally would be. You know, by now, a lot of people would have some cherry tomatoes at least that they'd be harvesting. But on the flip side of that, if you're a flower gardener, especially a perennial flower gardener, you've had a great year. Or if you're a berry grower, for that matter.
Yeah.
The blueberry crop has been really nice this year. Big size berries because of all the moisture that's in the soil. Same thing with the strawberry crop. And for perennial flowers, we've got some beautiful flowers out there because of the cool, moist weather that it does really well in Vermont. So a lot of those perennial flowers are big, they're lush, and they're getting some nice color on them now.
Well, that's interesting. You said it slows down the growing season when we get a lot of moisture. Is that because the temperatures are cooler? We're not getting the warmer temperatures?
The soil temperatures particularly, especially when you get all that rain early in May and in June, it's not really warming up as fast as it normally would. Now the things have dried out a little bit. We're getting less rain and more warmer temperatures. Temperatures next week should be up close to 90, I believe. You'll see things really as pop. And it's always amazing to me how within a week you'll see like a melon plant go from just a little seedling to something that's growing a couple feet wide.
Yeah.
So the plants will make up for the lost time.
Well, what we heard from Pat, and she emailed to tell us, she said, "Charlie, please tell me the reason why my tomato plants are so small. Tell me it's because of the wet weather and the cool summer. I fear my yields are going to be dismal. This is the first summer I decided to not use red or black plastic. Go figure. Flea beetles were abundant too, eating all of my radishes. Perennials and brambles are fantastic though, so there's always a bright side. And here's the great note. Mm-hmm. I love gardening.
Even in spite of all of that.
But tell her, is that the reason her tomato plants?
Yeah, with the tomatoes, exactly what we've been talking about. Perfect. For sure. Now, if you're in a colder area, if you're in the Northeast Kingdom or a more mountainous area where you have the threat of a frost coming a little bit earlier than other places, maybe as early as late August, early September, you're going to want to try to push things along pretty quickly. So if you're growing some heirloom tomatoes, for example, long season varieties, the Cherokee Purples, Green Zebras, Brandywines, those kinds of fruits, you might want to sacrifice a little of the production to make sure that you get enough ripe fruit that you can harvest before it gets too cold for them. Mm. So what that means is that as those suckers are forming on those large indeterminate plants, you want to snip them off. And the sucker is that little side branch that happens between the main stem or trunk and one of the side branches. In between that crotch right there is a little branch that forms. And if you had enough time, it would go into a flowering and fruiting branch. But if it's forming now, the end of July, it'll never have enough time in Vermont to do that. So you can just snip it off. It'll redirect the energy to the existing fruit and the new fruit that you have, so you'll get a better chance of them maturing.
All right. We also heard from Sheila. She posted on Facebook, "My potatoes are showing a blight of some sort. Mm. It does not appear to be late blight. The leaf edges are turning brown and dying back. Is there anything I can do?"
Well, if she's not sure, it would be good to get it checked, because there is some incidence of late blight in Vermont this summer. I know in Hinesburg and a few other places they've had it on potatoes. So it is important to check it, because it is the kind of disease that will devastate her whole crop very quickly. So the University of Vermont has a plant pathology lab where I think you can send samples and they will check it out. Make sure it's not late blight. Assuming it's not late blight and there's just some browning on the leaf edges and it's just some foliar discoloration, don't worry too much about it. Potatoes are tough crops. Mm. If they don't get late blight, they're really tough crops. And even with things like the Colorado potato beetle, which can munch on the leaves and defoliate plants, you can lose up to a third of the foliage of your potato plants and still get a good harvest.
Oh, that's great to hear.
So they're a really tough crop. And so if you have a little bit of damage here and there, don't worry so much about it. The overall health is really what you're looking for.
All right. And Dan in Stowe says, "I'm growing watermelon and cantaloupe for the first time this summer. I have lots of flowers on my plant, but no fruit yet. Any suggestions?" Is he just getting a little too anxious?
Pray for sun and heat.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly where I am, and I live in Ferrisburg.
Yeah.
We have our plants are spreading beautifully, watermelons and cantaloupes. We've got a lot of flowers. I'm starting to see some little fruits forming, but it's certainly behind where it would be. But all it's going to take is a couple warm weeks. If you get a couple of nice 80, 90-degree weeks, a lot of sunshine, those plants will really take off, and they'll start forming the fruit.
Excellent. You have an opportunity to ask your questions of Charlie Nardozzi. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We've got Diane in Berkshire calling. Diane, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment for Charlie?
Hi. I'm growing Brussels sprouts for the first time this year, and something's eating at my leaves. And I was also wondering if you had any tips for growing Brussels sprouts.
Sure, yes. So Brussels sprouts are in that whole broccoli family, the cabbage family. And so there's an insect, the cabbage worm, that loves them. And if you have holes in the leaves and it looks like they're eating the leaves away, if you look really closely in the center of that growth point of the Brussels sprouts, you probably see some dark green frass, which is droppings, basically. Mm-hmm. And And if you see that, that means you have these green worms eating. And they're camouflaged. Nature is perfect with this because they're camouflaged with just the same hue and tone and shade of green as the leaf of that plant. So the birds can't find them. But, of course, it's hard for you and I to find them, too. The simple solution for them is an organic spray that is very safe. It's been out there for years. It's called Bacillus thuringiensis. It goes under the trade names Dipal and Thuricide. And it's specific to the cabbage worm butterfly, cabbage worm larvae, and it will kill them pretty quickly, within a couple of days. So I would suggest getting some of that and spraying all your plants, and not just the Brussels sprouts, but cabbage, kale, broccoli, anything in that family. Cauliflower would be another one. Another tip for Brussels sprouts, one of the problems people often have is that the sprouts don't form. They get to September and they've got a beautiful big plant and there's no sprouts forming along the main stem. If you get to late August, early September, and that's happening in your garden, just whack the top of it off. Just cut the top off, the top 6 inches. That'll take the growth point off and put all more energy into forming those sprouts all along the stem.
Now, you mentioned kale. We heard from Jesse in South Burlington, posted on Facebook, "I am a new transplant to Vermont and an avid gardener. Something ate my kale completely. In 3 days, all the leaves were gone. Only the stems were left. It can't be bunnies because the lettuce and herbs were intact. Any pointers on how to protect the new crop?"
Well, if they're small plants, it could be those cabbage worms because they are very voracious. And if it's a small little seedling, they'll just decimate it right down to the stems. So if they're dead, don't worry about it because kale is a great plant to be replanting this time of year, which is a good thing to do for a lot of vegetables this time of year. Late crops of beans, carrots, beets, kale, any of the greens, lettuce, spinach pretty soon. You can be sowing those now or transplanting plants that you started indoors now into the garden. But the key, though, is that with the kale, give it some of those sprays with that Dipal or Thuricide I was mentioning for the Brussels sprouts so that those cabbage worms won't get started on it.
Great. Let's take Pete in Rutland. He has a question, a good follow-up to what you just talked about. Pete, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question for Charlie?
Yes, Charlie, you just started to answer my question. I was wondering what I can plant in my garden now that I'm harvesting some of my lettuces and getting some areas open. What can I plant for a fall crop?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot more fall gardening, meaning I plant things for the fall because I've been noticing with our weather, we've been getting warmer falls. It's been extended deeper into the season so that you can get some great crops of vegetables right into November, December sometime. Mm-hmm. So as the peas are done, as the lettuce, as the radishes are done, if a cucumber plant dies or a squash plant dies, pull those things out and then amend the soil with some compost and then come back in with things that would be quick maturing, cool season crops. So I mentioned them earlier, a lot of the root crops. The beets, carrots, radishes might be a little early for them. I'd wait till August for that. And then all the leafy green crops, more kale, collards, Swiss chard, lettuces, spinach again, kind of like the radishes. You probably wait till August when it gets a little cooler to put those in. But you can plant all of those and even a late crop of beans. You can put beans in till the end of this month and still get a crop of them by September. So there's a lot of options that you can put in there. It's really just a matter of what you want to eat and what you have room to fit in that space.
Even in the middle of summer, there's no rest for the garden.
That's right.
Love it. We're talking gardening today with garden expert and consultant Charlie Nardozzi. Coming up, we'll discuss the beetles and the stones. Well, actually, the Japanese beetles. And we want to hear from you. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page. I'm Rick Singeri. This is Vermont Edition. It's our summer gardening show. Garden expert and consultant Charlie Nardozzi, host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR, is here to solve whatever problem you might have with your vegetables, flowers, trees, or shrubs. If you're new to gardening and need to know something basic, Charlie loves to help you get started. And he's with us here for the whole hour. So if you haven't been able to get through yet, don't give up. We want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Charlie, I promise we'd talk about beetles because we have had some questions from listeners already. So let's start with Susan. And this is kind of epic.
All right. Epic, okay.
16 years ago, when my husband and I moved to Westminster West, we had thousands of rose chaffers and Japanese beetles. We thought we had landed in a grade B horror movie. We handpicked the destructive buggers for hours each day. One day we counted 10,000 and got even more on that one day alone. Our local garden store recommended Milky Spore. We applied it that same year. We didn't see any reduction in the numbers the following season. And someone told us that Milky Spore didn't work in our area due to the cold winters. We don't have nearly those numbers now, but we still pick at least 200 a day during the height of the long cycles, and they still do quite a bit of damage. We want to grow food, not kill beetles. Fast forward to today's climate. Do you think it would work given that it's warmer now, talking about the Milky Spore?
All right. Yeah, that is epic. Thousands of beetles. Yeah, wow. I thought I had a bad infestation. Well, let me do a little Japanese beetle 101 and give you some new information that's out there, a new organic product that I've been trying this summer fairly successfully.
Perfect.
So there's lots of things you can do with Japanese beetles. The hand picking, obviously, if you have small infestations and a few plants here and there, go out in the morning when they're sluggish with a small little pail of soapy water. And actually, you don't even have to pick them. You just put the pail under the plant and shake it, and they have a reflex reaction. It's kind of a roll and drop reflex reaction where they'll roll off the leaf and drop to the ground because they want to burrow and get protected in the ground. And of course, they'll fall into your pail of soapy water. So that's, if you have a small infestation, that's probably one of the best things to do. Just make it a daily habit. Every morning, go out there before you go to work to spend 10, 15 minutes picking beetles.
Okay.
You can try some sprays. Neem oil, people have tried with varying degrees of success. I haven't really had a lot of personal success with neem oil, but supposedly neem oil will actually ward them off, as well as insecticidal soap. You can try the Japanese beetle pheromone traps, and a lot of people will curse these because they do draw the Japanese beetles in. The key with those, though, is to trap them en masse. So get your neighbors trapping, get people around you trapping. If you're the only one in your neighborhood trapping, guess what happens? They all come to your house for lunch. So you want to do that so that everyone is trapping them, or you want to put them upwind if you're out in a more rural area, so that the beetles, as they're coming into your yard, will hit the trap before you hit your plants. Because if you put it too close to the plants, they'll come, they'll munch on the plants, they won't even bother with the trap.
Okay.
So those are some of the basic things that people have used for the adults. For the grubs, one of the nicest things to do is to use beneficial nematodes. Now, she used Milky Spore disease, and she was right to think that it does not work very well in Vermont, and it is because of our cool soils. The bacteria does not overwinter in the soil, is not very effective. Even if you apply it 2 to 3 times the recommended dosage, it's still not very effective. But beneficial nematodes do work. You have to reapply them every year, and you apply them in June or in late August and September. You will spray them on the lawn areas around where they like to feed. So around the roses, around the basil, around the cherries and the grapes and all the plants that you know that they're going to be around. They're laying their eggs right in that area. They don't go across your yard to lay the eggs. They're right there. And so once those eggs hatch, this beneficial nematodes are microscopic little wireworms. Mm-hmm. They will go on a little seek and destroy mission, and they'll parasitize the grubs in the soil. So if you can kill the grubs, of course, you then stop the whole life cycle and you kill the adults for the next year. So I think annual applications of beneficial nematodes would be really a good idea. You do it towards the evening, watered in really well. What I've been playing with this year are some new ideas. One is kaolin clay. Now, kaolin clay is a kind of clay that's mined in China, of all places. It's very fine powder, and you spray it on things, and it creates this white film. So I've sprayed it on my cherry trees, apricots, plums, and grapes. And it creates a white film that the Japanese beetle adults don't really like. I've been noticing they land on them. They feed a little bit. You know, because of all the rain, it's been hard for me to keep up with it. So they have caused some damage, but certainly nothing like it's been in the past. So they're there, but because of that dusty material, they don't stay around. The only downside of kaolin clay, it's purely organic, it's safe and all of that. The downside, of course, is that it discolors the plant. It turns it white. So if you have roses, for example, you're probably not going to want to use it on your rose plants unless you like white roses. So the other option is a new form of BT. We've been talking about Bacillus thuringiensis for cabbage worms.
Right.
There's a version of it for Colorado potato beetles, for mosquitoes, for flea beetle, fungus gnats. Now there's a version for Japanese beetles. It's called BT Galleriae. And it's the common name of it that's sold under is Beetlejuice, J-U-S. There's only one company that I know of that you can buy it from right now. It's a mail order company, so people can contact me if they want to get it. And I've been trying it, and it seems to work pretty well. I've been spraying it on our roses. Again, I see the beetles there, especially on the new flowers. because you spray it and then a day later the flowers open and they're not protected.
Yep.
But the foliage looks really nice and it works the same way as other BTs. The beetle eats the foliage, eats the bacteria, it parasitizes them or affects their gut and kills them within a couple days. So that's another nice arsenal thing to have in your arsenal for controlling the Japanese beetle.
All right. Now, before we get back to the calls, I want to jump back to the beneficial nematodes. First
yes.
of all, Charlie, you should know that if the VPR staff ever forms a band or a softball team, we're going to call ourselves the Beneficial Nematodes because of you. But Niall emailed this, and he says, how do I get the Japanese beetle grubs out of the lawn? I understand that nematodes are not effective this far north, but you found that they are.
Yes, they are effective. They will not overwinter. That's the thing. The nice thing about milky spore that we talked about earlier is further south in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that bacteria, once it's established in the soil, you don't have to keep reapplying it. It will overwinter. It'll be there and it'll parasitize the grubs. Up this far north, not only does that bacteria not overwinter, the beneficial nematodes do not overwinter. So you do have to annually apply it.
Got it.
But if you do that, it will reduce the population.
All right. Let's go to Sylvia. She's calling from Bath, New Hampshire. Sylvia, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question for Charlie?
Well, I have some cucumber plants and some squash plants, and both are getting very bad mildew. At least I think that's what it is in the lower leaves, which I keep picking off, but I'm wondering how many I can pick off before I destroy the plant. They are beginning to make fruit, but I just I don't know what to do about the mildew. Can you help me?
Sure, yeah. A lot of the squash plants, the cucurbit plants, will get mildew, and because of the rain and the conditions, the weather conditions we've had, we've seen a lot of that earlier on than we normally would see that. So there are a couple things you can do, for sure. Trying to get the plant so it's not so crowded with other plants around it, so there's more airflow around the plant, so the leaves dry off. That will help reduce the incidence of that and spread of that powdery mildew. And there is an organic fungicide called Serenade, or Bacillus subtilis, another bacteria. You can kind of see that this is kind of a wave in the organic agricultural world. They're using a lot of bacteria and fungi to fight not only insects but other microbes. So this bacteria, Bacillus subtilis, will fight the fungus that causes the powdery mildew. And you spray it on the leaves, and again, it has to be reapplied after a rain, for example. And it's best to put it on the leaves that are not infected, so it will not allow it to spread to those new leaves. But that seems to work pretty well. I've used it on tomatoes for blight, mm-hmm. For foliar diseases, and for a black spot on roses, as well as powdery mildew.
All right, so here's a question about a certain crop wheat. Don't normally get a question about. Lynn in Montpelier says that she has a crop of hops and they're fruiting really well right now, but the leaves are being eaten. What should she do?
Well, depends on what's eating the leaves. I think that would be the first thing. Yeah, if it's a Japanese beetle might be going after the hops. It could be something smaller, some kind of worm. It's hard to really know without seeing it. But I think the first step would be to identify, is it an insect that's eating the leaves? Is it a disease that's somehow on the leaves? If it's only a little bit of the damage, you have to kind of make a determination of, is it worth really doing anything about? If the strobiles are forming and the hops are looking good, otherwise, it may be fine just to kind of leave it and let Mother Nature take over and slowly kind of reduce any kind of problem.
And we also got this note from Scott, who says, I'm an entomologist. I want to just make a quick note about the kaolin spray, the Chinese clay.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
If you spray it on with a piston sprayer, it will destroy your piston because it's an abrasive. So a diaphragm sprayer is what you should be using.
That's a good point.
Well.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Great.
Excellent. And let's now take a call from Vicky. She's calling from Monroe, New Hampshire. Vicky, what's your question for Charlie Nardozzi?
Hi. We tend to plant a lot of zucchini plants rather than in a hill, rather than limiting it to only two or three. And I've noticed that, which I understand it's not a good idea, but in any case, so we have a lot of leaves, a lot of plants, a lot of leaves, and I noticed that the blossoms seem to be a lot of them falling off. So I'm just wondering, in general, if you do like plant zucchini too close, are the leaves shading too much, as well as, you know, the not enough nutrients or whatever?
Great question, Vicky. We also heard from Diane, who posted this. My zucchini plants look healthy, but the zucchinis start to grow, and then the end turns brown and shrivel and stop growing. Too wet, poor soil, It almost looks like blossom and rot. Any suggestions? So let's talk zucchini, Charlie.
So we'll talk zucchini for Debbie and Diane.
Yeah.
So planting a lot of zucchini plants in a hill, she's right in that it's not the advised thing to do. You should really only have a couple plants there at the most. If you put too many in there, they're competing for water, for nutrients. You're going to have smaller plants. You're going to have smaller fruits. You have more likelihood of things not getting pollinated properly. So the best thing to do would be to thin it out so that you just have two plants there. That would probably solve a lot of the problems. And then give it some fertilizer. That's something we haven't talked about yet. But doing some side dressing of fertilizer this time of year for vegetables is a great idea, especially things that are just coming into production, like cucumbers and squashes and tomatoes. A little organic fertilizer, like an equivalent of a 5-5-5, just around the drip line of the plant would be a nice thing to really boost it and keep it going through the season. Now, why zucchini is not forming fruit, or the fruits that are forming are rotting,
right,
that could be due to the weather and more due to lack of pollinating insects. Because everything in the cucurbit family, squashes, melons, cucumbers, they have male and female flowers for the most part. There are varieties that are what we call gynoecious or parthenocarpic, and they will be able to set their own fruit. But for the most part, they have male and female flowers, and they need pollination for the fruit to be set. And that's usually done with bees.
Right.
So we all know about the honeybee collapse disorder and lack of bumblebees and native bees. So probably what's happening is that those flowers are not getting pollinated properly. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get pollinated properly, then the fruit may look like it's forming, but then all of a sudden it will just kind of drop off. So part of that's due to the weather. If a lot of cloudy weather, the bees aren't flying so much, and the flowers only open for a few hours in the morning, and that's it. So you got your opportunity. What you can do is you can play bee. You can get a little cotton swab, like a Q-tip, and go in and identify a male flower and a female flower. The male flower will have just a straight stem behind the flower. A female flower will have a little version of whatever it is you're growing, little zucchini, little melon, little cucumber, whatever it is. So the flowers will be open usually mid-morning, a good reason not to go to work that day. And you can go in to the male flower and take that little Q-tip and just swish it around so it turns yellow. You collect the pollen, basically. Go over to the female flower, swish it around in there, and that should be enough that you actually pollinate that flower and it'll form a fruit.
I love that we can play bumblebee.
There you go.
That's fabulous. We'll take another call. You can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Michael in Pulteney. Michael, thanks for calling. What's your question for Charlie? Oh, we lost Michael. How about Michael in Cambridge? We got another Michael.
I'll take
Step
that, Michael.
Right up, Michael. Michael in Cambridge? Yeah, go ahead. What's your question?
I grow wheatgrass, and I was wondering, hello?
Yep, we got you, wheatgrass.
Yeah, and I was wondering if I should grow it twice. Do I lose any nutritional value if I harvest it the first time and let it grow again?
Oh, as far as nutritional value, I'm not sure. I would think that it would be more tender the first time as it grows up and you cut it back. When it comes back the second time, it might be a little tougher, more lignin to it, maybe not as much juice per se in it. But as far as the nutritional content, I don't think it would make that much of a difference.
All right. And then Basha wrote in, my broccoli plants are making heads. I think I put too much compost on the bed. Is there anything to do besides wait? So is it possible to do too much compost?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Good question, Basha. You can buy compost in bags or in bulk now. And the temptation, especially with container and raised bed gardeners, is I'm just going to fill it up with compost, right?
Right.
But the compost can be very rich, especially if it was created in a very efficient way. It could have a lot of nitrogen to it. And what ends up happening is you get plants that will be big and lush and the big leaves and everything looks great, but you're not getting a lot of flowering and fruiting. And the reason for that is that you've created a nitrogen imbalance in the soil. So it'll take a while for the soil to kind of correct itself. So that's why if you're growing things in containers and in large containers and in raised beds, to do a mix of topsoil and compost is much better than straight compost. So as far as Basha and her broccoli, if it's not forming a head yet, it's okay. It's still only July.
That's right.
And if the leaves are big and lush and you're keeping the cabbage worms off them, just give it some time because nitrogen is a very volatile compound. It will leach out of the soil, evaporate into the atmosphere pretty quickly. So it'll kind of balance itself out over time.
Excellent. All right. We're talking with garden expert and consultant Charlie Nardozzi. He's here to answer your questions. We'd also love to hear from you if you got something that's really working for you this year in your vegetable or flower garden, let us know. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. More of your calls just ahead. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. Today, we're getting down and dirty with Charlie Nardozzi. He's a garden expert and consultant and host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR. We're taking your calls and emails with questions about your gardens. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. And before we get back to those, I want to talk to you about something else, Charlie. Mm-hmm. At the end of September, you'll be leading a food and garden tour of Sicily. So give us a few of the highlights of that tour.
Oh, yeah. We're very excited about this tour. So we're going September 24th to October 3rd, and we're going to really be focusing on kind of the east and south of Sicily. Sicily, of course, is an island, and it's pretty large, and you can go all over. But we're focusing on public and private gardens you can go to and food. And if you don't know anything about Sicily or have never been there, it's very different than the rest of Italy. It's really a cultural crossroads. The Greeks were there, the Arabs were there, the Normans were there, the Spanish were there, and of course the Romans were there. So there's a lot of different mixes of cultures going on, and that gets reflected in the gardens and the food. So we'll be doing a couple different cooking classes. We'll be going to an herb nursery, learning about growing Sicilian herbs, culinary and medicinal, and doing cooking classes there. We'll be doing another cooking class with a 4-star Michelin chef up in Taormina in the foothills of Mount Etna. We might even be going to the Brante Pistachio Festival, because they grow pistachios and oranges on the foothills of Mount Etna there. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be a combination of some beautiful estate gardens, private small gardens, great cooking, a lot of free time to wander around. So if you're interested in joining us, we would love to have you. Just go to my website, gardeningwithcharlie.com, and look under the Meet Charlie tab, and you'll see the trip is outlined right there.
All right. And we'll also have a link to that on our Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, we heard from Sarah, who posted this comment, Charlie, heard us talking about the bees, said, "I'm trying to let my front yard go to meadow. I'm doing this because we have honeybees, and I'd like to encourage the birds, butterflies, and other bees in the area. Plus, I think it looks better. The problem is my neighbors keep asking me if my mower is broken."
Yes.
I've now started planting small shrubs, ferns, flowers, etc., as well as installed a bird bath to show that I'm not just neglecting my yard.
Right.
What else could I do to show that this is how I want my yard to be so my neighbors stop asking?
Yes, that's a good point, because it is important to have a lot of wildflowers for the bees and pollinators and beneficial insects. But often, if you have a small yard and maybe your front yard is your only green space that you have, to turn it into a meadow like that can look like it's just kind of disheveled and just letting all the weeds grow.
Right.
So the best thing to do is really come up with a design. Come up with an idea of how can I incorporate this wildflower meadow into what else I'm doing in my yard. So she's on her way to that by putting some shrubs in, a little water feature, bird baths, whatever it is. But don't just let it just grow and just think, okay, it's just going to grow into weeds and that'll be fine. The bees will like it, but it's not going to look so great for your neighbors. But if you have maybe a hedgerow of shrubs along a side of it, or maybe between you and the walkway, so that there's a little bit of a visual block, that might help. And it doesn't have to be just regular shrubs. It can be edible shrubs. You can put blueberries in there, for example, or Rosa rugosas, and have the rose hips that you can make tea out of. So if you think of it more in terms of how can I design my yard so that meadow is in there and I have these other elements, then it's going to be more attractive, not only for you, but for your neighbors too.
Okay. And Kate emailed, "I have a question. I'm growing wildflowers from seed. Over the last few years, I've been collecting seeds from local wildflowers and trying to grow them the following year. I've been very unsuccessful growing any from seeds, but have had much better results by transplanting. Do you have any tips or suggestions for growing wildflowers from seed?"
Yeah, so a lot of the wildflowers will be forming their seed, like the black-eyed Susans and the coneflowers, this summer and fall. And so the temptation is to collect them and then bring them inside. But you have to realize how nature works is that those seeds normally will just drop to the ground, and then they have a whole winter where they'll get exposed to cold temperatures and moisture. And unless you're doing something similar to that inside in your house, that's probably why they're not germinating, growing well the next year. So what I would suggest is collect the seed, decide where you want to put that in your yard, and be Johnny Appleseed or Johnny Coneflower Seed and start sprinkling it around in those areas. Do that in the fall and then just let them settle there, and then they'll germinate on their own. The other option would be to put them in some plastic bags and or put them in a with a little bit of moisture on them, maybe a little peat moss or something, and put them in a real cool place too, so you get that winterization happening indoors.
It's all about science.
Yeah.
And then we heard from Jane in Moncton, and we think this is someone whose last name rhymes with Indholm, the host of this show.
Okay.
She says some people love morning glories and how they twine up a trellis on the side of the house and have those beautiful flowers. I agree, they are beautiful, but they are completely overwhelming the plants around my house. They choke our bushes and flowers, and they're so tenacious. How can I get rid of them, or should I just learn to live with them, given how much the bees seem to love them?
Yes, so morning glories will self-sow. We're just talking about plants that self-sow readily. Morning glories, once you have them, you'll have them forever. They'll just keep coming up and up and up. So what you'll have to do is, in the spring, be able to identify what the little morning glory seedling looks like and be very tenacious about weeding it out, kind of knocking it down, weeding it out. That would be probably the best way to try to reduce it in the landscape. There's also a weed called bindweed that kind of looks like a wild morning glory, and that one's even more aggressive than the cultivated one. And that one you really have to try to weed out and try to get the roots out as well, because that's more of a perennial.
Okay. Well, watch out for that one, Jane.
Yes.
All right, let's go back to the calls. You can join us at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Carl in St. Johnsbury. Carl, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question for Charlie?
Hi, Rick. Charlie. I got a couple of really nice butternut trees. And this year they're producing really good, but in the past the squirrels have gotten to them before I have, and I really need to know, if you know, how you can tell if they're ripe enough to pick.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. You know, usually you would see that the actual hull would start forming and maybe even turning a little brownish kind of color, but I'm not exactly sure exactly what point you would have to be able to pick them. But I'm sure there are some nurserymen out there who do know this, or some old-timers, actually, mm-hmm. some old farmers probably, who used to gather butternuts and some of the walnuts, and they might be a good source of information for something like that.
All right. Let's take another call from Michael, this time from Pulteney. Michael, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question for Charlie?
Yes, good afternoon. This year we put in an asparagus patch. They are coming up nicely. Problem is the loam that we bought seems to have been one-third weed seed. Heard we can dress it with salt. Is this true, and how much?
Yes, salt does work, but it's not recommended. Because asparagus is actually a Mediterranean plant, and you often will see it if you go to Italy or south of France. You'll see it just kind of growing along the coastline there because it can tolerate a lot of salt, and a lot of weeds can't. But the problem is, if you put down salt into your asparagus bed to kill the weeds, you're going to change that soil so much that it's going to become toxic for the asparagus itself too. So it's really not recommended to use salt to kill it. Unfortunately, the only thing that really would work is just to be very diligent about weeding yourself. Now, what we've done with our asparagus bed is that, you know, asparagus, really the crown itself, it slowly expands. And so you can actually mulch around it. And we've actually put cardboard on either side of it and cover that with hay. And that will keep the weeds from around it not encroaching on the patch. And then it's a smaller area that you have to weed in between.
All right. And let's take another call from Kim. She's calling from Johnson. Kim, thanks for joining Vermont Edition. What's your question for Charlie?
Hey there, we have a garlic patch that I thought was surviving, but compared to everybody's garlic, it has not been growing, and it's turning yellow, and as some disappeared, I started to pull some up, dig some up, and it's got these little white, mealy, little, like when I say little, less than a quarter of an inch big, that are eating the garlic.
And so that's one story about garlic. Now, Phil in Berlin says, what should I do with my garlic? Very few leaves have turned brown, and those that have that I've pulled look terrific. Do I just yank them at this point? I'm dying to get my second broccoli and cauliflower starts in their beds. I've never seen them look so healthy so late in the season. So a story of two garlic.
That's exactly.
All right, so let's go first with Kim's.
Okay, so Kim, I forgot, where was Kim again?
In Johnson.
Oh, in Johnson. All right. There is a new insect, relatively new, on the scene. I know it's in Chittenden County. I'm not sure if it's in Johnson. It's called a leek moth, and it attacks not only leeks but garlic and onions. And so that little worm that you might be seeing might be the larval form of that leek moth, which is too bad because it will destroy the bulb under the soil. The only thing that seems to work the best for it is if you can cover your planting of garlic in the spring with a floating row cover so that the adult cannot lay the egg on the garlic itself, then you won't have that problem. problem. So that's something I think it's probably good to get it identified positively if that's really what the problem is, and then next year you'll kind of know what to do.
Gotcha.
As far as the successful one,
Phil's beautiful garlic.
You should really wait for those bottom leaves to start at least turning yellow a little bit. But if you dig down and you've got a nice sized bulb of garlic down there and it looks pretty good, you can probably pull it out. I just pulled out our garlic, actually, the other day. And as long as it's better to get it on the early side than the late side. If you put it on the late side, you'll see the actual cloves start separating, and then it's not going to store as well. So you might want to think about this weekend doing a little garlic pulling.
All right. And so I think we have time for one more question. McGill writes, I have three beautiful hydrangea bushes. That is, the leaves are beautiful, but for 3 years now, I have no flowers. They circle a tall 10-year-old maple tree. I do not prune them, but do mulch them heavily in the fall, worrying about winter damage. Are they getting too much shade from the tree?
They could be. You know, hydrangeas do well, okay, in part shade, but if they're getting too much shade, there may not be enough energy for them to actually form flowers. So you might want to decide to move one of them into a sunny spot and see what happens.
There we go. Charlie Nardozzi is a garden consultant who's always willing to help out a fellow gardener, and you can connect with him at his website. That's gardeningwithcharlie.org, and we have a link at vpr.net. Charlie, always a pleasure to have you.
It's always fun to be here, Rick.
Now, Monday on Vermont Edition, it's back to politics. Governor Peter Shumlin is our guest. Among other things, we'll look at a congressional challenge to Vermont's GMO labeling law. You can send your questions for Governor Shumlin to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Rick Singeri. Have a great weekend.